Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio on the 31st of July 2013. My name's Hereward Fenton. I'll be your host for the next hour. Welcome to another show. Today's show is going to be short and sweet. I don't have a second hour. We'll be replaying the interview with John Bursell during the second hour that I did a week ago, and I do encourage you to listen to that if you didn't get it last week. It's a really interesting exploration there of John's political interests and the fact that he's standing for the Bobcatter Australian Party. But in the first hour of today's show, I want to focus on a couple of issues, and I want to highlight a couple of things. Firstly, I want to emphasise that, you know, what is the role of a show like Truth News Radio? And I submit to you that that in fact our role is, to a large extent, to simply stand witness or bear witness to things that are unjust and that haven't been properly addressed in the media, and to actually actively express outrage, to give a voice to that outrage that everyone feels, because it needs to have a channel. Now, that, of course, will not in itself fix the problems, and it can also be seen as simply a dwelling on negativity, and many people I've spoken to in the past have said, you know, why do you carry on about all this stuff? Why do you fill your mind with all this negative stuff? And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, yes, it's true. You know, I'm filling my mind with negative things. And, you know, why don't you talk about something nice? Or, you know, why is it always about problems? You know, there's some truth in that, isn't there? But I think that what's missing in that analysis is the recognition of the degree to which awareness and the free flow of information is suppressed in our modern civilization. And so simply repeating things publicly, making public what people are thinking, is actually necessary to trigger a change, to escape from the cognitive dissonance that is keeping everyone locked in to a paradigm. And of course, this is happening around the world with alternative media. We are kind of talking to each other to wake each other up, and we don't really know what the full outcome of that is going to be. But I do think that there will be an outcome, ladies and gentlemen. I believe that that things have changed, are changing, and will change. But we need to be very careful and think about the direction in which things are going to change. Things can spring out of our own subconscious. The suppressed movements that we have for liberty, for awareness of crimes and truth and justice in so many areas, these things that we feel that are so suppressed that we have no voice, well, one day that voice may suddenly surge forth. And we'll find that what was once a very fringe, subterranean movement suddenly becomes a very, very public mainstream movement with a lot of power. But it's just at that point, you know, it's just when that happens that the real danger lies, because that's when people's subconscious take over, and that's when the uninspected parts of your psyche that have all these prejudices and hatreds and undeveloped aspects of your psyche, of your spirit, suddenly come forth and actually produce a new problem. Sometimes they can produce a type of tyranny which was as bad or worse than the one which you're striving to replace. And I'm thinking of the French Revolution here, indeed the Russian Revolution, and indeed the Chinese Revolution, and indeed Pol Pot's revolution in Cambodia, to name a few. But, you know, when people are driven by something that is deep and real, and they have so much grievance against the system, When that finally emerges from the subterranean into the light of day, it can bring with it a lot of bad stuff too. So I believe it's very important to actually not only air our frustration, but to also critically look at everything that is being said on all viewpoints, and to understand where there might actually be blockages or prejudices that are unjust in our own expression. And that is also part of what I believe the role of Truth News Australia is to do, which is very, very different from the way a lot of people see what a radio show like this would be. You know, many people that I've sort of fallen out with over the years find it incredible, you know, when I don't toe the line on certain subjects, when I don't follow the peer group on certain topics, because it's like I'm letting the team down, you know, because I haven't, for example, supported the view that we're being sprayed by chemtrails in the skies. You know, people have declared that I'm some kind of traitor, perhaps an agent or an operative, in the sense that I don't, that I've undermined what they believe is something very important. But of course, all I've done in my research is I've just tried to remain open and to call it as I see it, and to basically use my own intellect to make a decision on whether something seems right or not. But unfortunately, many people, including many people in the Truth and libertarian community, sort of just fall back into this kind of peer group thing. I'll go with what my peer group thinks. I'll follow with what the team thinks. And I'm telling you, folks, it's a really dangerous way to be. It will inevitably lead to a repetition of the same sort of problems we now see in our society. And if you look back through history, you know, it's not surprising. This has happened again and again and again. This is the trap that we keep falling into. And I think it's largely the trap of not fully individuating ourselves, not becoming fully independent, free, individual human beings able to think and rationally consider. We still have the trappings of this tendency to want to go with what our tribe tells us. And for those of us who are part of the alternative communities, conspiracy theorists, truth activists, whatever phraseology you might want to use, there is still the tendency there to go with the tribe and not to actually use our ability to think. Now, after we come back from the break, I'm going to actually get back into the topic of refugees and why the policies of the Australian government in relation to boat people is barbaric, to use a word that John Pilger used, why it's utterly barbaric, and why many people, to reflect on the fact that many people who are perhaps listeners to this show sneakingly even agree with this idea of turning back the boats. And I believe that they are victims of the groupthink, of the peer group pressure, which has said to people, we must protect our sovereignty. You know, we're a sovereign nation. We must protect our borders. We can't let these people come in. And that mantra, that sort of idea, then becomes like the barrier to understanding what the real issue is with asylum seekers and refugees. You know, and that's what I actually want to get into in more depth is, you know, what is that real issue? They're people whose lives have been destroyed in countries around the world that have been ripped apart by the military-industrial complex, by the globalist agendas, which are currently just causing utter chaos around the world. Things have got really bad. There's a lot more refugees now than there were, say, 10 years ago. But the same forces that are the ones that we that we recognize and oppose as truth activists, the globalist forces, these are the same forces that are creating the refugee crisis. And recognizing that, we also have to understand that these refugees are real people. They're just flesh and blood human beings. They're not part of it. They're not part of the grand design of the schemes of the globalists. They're just people whose lives have been torn apart, and they don't have anywhere to go. So, while I totally agree that we must address and counteract the propaganda and the strategies of the globalists, we must also show compassion for the victims of that. We must. It's a requirement of your moral being that you understand that we have to have compassion. And however corrupt the system is, however engineered it was, these are real people, folks. You know, they're not just numbers. They're not just statistics. They're real people who are desperate, who've come to Australia on boats. And what's happening is now, well, through successive different governments, but basically what has been done is these people are being thrown into gulags offshore in utterly inhumane conditions that you wouldn't even put a dog in Australia. So it's a crime against humanity. It's an unbelievable, appalling crime against humanity that is being perpetrated by our smiling, loving politicians of both sides of the polarized left-right dictatorship. So that is coming up, and I've got an article here to read to you by John Pilger. But before I get into that, I want to address something else that's come up on the news feeds, and it's back on a topic which I put quite a lot of work into last year in regard to the questions about abortion and reproductive rights, as it's often described by the left, and whether in fact some people are advocating that that it would be okay to terminate the life of a baby, you know, after it's born. There's been some an article came up on Natural News that was quoting an NBC host, news host, Melissa Perry, and basically asserting that she had said essentially that that she would endorse that idea, or that in fact babies don't become persons until the parent actually feels like they do. That's the way it's presented in the article there by Mike Adams. Well, I've done a bit of research into that, and I feel it's been incorrectly represented, and I feel it needs to be called out. So I'm going to get back into that when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and we'll be right back. Do stay with us. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Like they want us to be afraid, man. Or maybe we just like being afraid. Maybe we just so used to it at this point that it's just a part of us, part of our culture. Security alert on orange. It's been on orange since 01, G. I mean, what's up, man? Can a brother get yellow, man? Just for like 2 months or something? Goddamn. Sick of that. Mic check. The groove is thick, so I'ma rhyme like a lunatic. I do this shit with an unassuming wit. The corporation conjured up the bass and the tempo. My name is Lift, that's the intro, now let's go. The flow of life throwing strife into the mix, to the big bang.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It's great to have your company today. And do check us out if you want to see our podcasts, if you want to have a look at some of the articles that we've got on the website. Just put Truth News Radio Australia into Google and sign up for our podcasts. And you can also join our Facebook page. If you're an Australian, you may find that worth doing. But even if not, you may find it worth doing. There's a lot of news that comes up on there, and certainly slightly different slant to what you'll find on a lot of different websites and Facebook pages. So I'd say give it a try. Now, just returning to the subject here of the question about newborn infants and and abortion. There's an article here from naturalnews.com by Mike Adams. Title of the article is MSNBC host says newborn infants don't count as alive unless parents decide they do. Infanticide is the new abortion. Now, yeah, that's a pretty shocking headline, and of course this is being repeated all over the internet because Natural News is a pretty popular site. And I was curious about it because I certainly thought, well, this is a pretty shocking theme, and it's something that I have looked at in the past, and there have been people coming forward saying this type of thing. There was an article in the Journal of Medical Ethics, which was written by some Australian academics about a year ago, which actually proposed the idea, purely theoretically, that post-birth abortion could actually be considered as ethical. And it was horrific. I mean, I went into that in great depth, and I had some people on the show talking about it. And believe me, I'm totally against it. I think it's abhorrent. It's unbelievable. It's wrong. And so I thought, okay, here, well, looks like we've got another person saying the same thing. So I followed all the links and I read the article. I'll just read some more from the article here. Today, Natural News denounces Melissa Harris-Perry, the latest talking head death worshipper, to publicly imply that she supports the murder of living, breathing newborn children. According to Harris-Perry, life begins when the parents feel like life begins. And together with some twisted new ethics arguments from the radical left, this can include months or years after a child is born. Now, so I'll just quickly paraphrase some of what is being said in here. The article is purporting to say that Melissa Harris-Perry is adding to this argument that was in the Journal of Medical Ethics and was basically supporting that view. And he says here, MSNBC's talking head Melissa Harris-Perry insists that life only begins when the parents have a feeling that it begins. When does life begin? I submit the answer depends an awful lot on the feeling of the parents. A powerful feeling, but not science. And in one stroke, she simultaneously condones the murder of newborn infants while attacking the science of biology, which unambiguously states that a living, breathing infant with a heartbeat and brain function is alive, not dead. Okay, that's the interpretation that we're given here in the article. But what I want to do now is actually play to you the actual clip of what this woman said. And I want you to compare that with the way it's been represented in the article here by Mike Adams. And I do have a link to that video, and I'll be putting it on the website. Here we go.
When a pregnancy is wanted by the mother and father, their family, their community, even their country, it is easy to think of the bump as a baby. But not every pregnancy is a fairy tale. There are other stories. An ultrasound reveals severe birth defects. A child is raped and becomes pregnant. Another baby would jeopardize a mother's ability to feed her living children. A woman decides she does not want a child at all. These are different pregnancies. They're reminders that an unwanted pregnancy can be biologically the same as a wanted one, but the experience can be entirely different. Eggs are fertilized. embryos implant, cells divide and multiply, fetuses grow. But when does life begin? I submit the answer depends an awful lot on the feeling of the parents, a powerful feeling, but not science.
Okay, now the key point here I want to emphasize is that the very last thing she said there is that many policymakers want to base laws on those feelings. And she's saying that's a problem. She's not saying that's a good thing. That very last part of what she said is not included in the quote that Mike Adams put into his article and which has since been replicated all over the internet. Now, so what she's actually saying here is that people have a feeling about when they're actually pregnant, to the extent of having a person inside them. In other words, that there is a feeling there that is that there is a new person inside you. And that that occurs at a certain point, and that that is what determines for people in practice whether or not the baby is alive. And to that extent, I actually do believe that is quite correct. And that the feeling is something that sometimes people have it right from the very beginning. Sometimes people have it from that moment of fertilization. But sometimes people have it when, in fact, there is no baby. I mean, there are many. It's very, very common to for women to think they're pregnant and not be pregnant. And that feeling, I believe, is still the same feeling. It's the feeling of, oh, I'm having a baby, and then it's the psychological projection that you project into this new person, which may or may not exist. The article that is on Natural News, I believe, is unfair and misrepresents what Melissa Harris-Perry is saying. And I'm not saying she's a great person. I'm not saying I agree with everything she says. I think she's a little ambiguous about it when she talks about this feeling versus science, and I can't even tell what she agrees with, what she thinks important, but there was no indication in anything she said there that she's endorsing the idea of parents killing their children. And I think that's kind of naughty on the part of people putting media out, people putting alternative news articles out, basically misrepresenting, because it only just adds to the confusion and the kind of muddying of the waters that we get. Because, look, there are people out there saying really bad things. It does need to be counteracted. It does need to be addressed when it occurs. But when you misrepresent someone, then, well, sooner or later someone's going to realize that wasn't quite correct. You know, that person didn't really say that. It was quoted out of context. And what happens then is that the whole argument then becomes weakened, because you've got people who are actually saying things that aren't quite accurate. And then that kind of tarnishes the whole argument of many, many other people who are actually just trying to talk common sense. And common sense and just basic universal values is what drives me and most of the people I know who are truth seekers. We're not part of some kind of fringe group who has extreme beliefs. We actually gravitate towards the most universally acknowledged views about what is true and real in this world. Again, mischaracterizations can occur through misreporting. Listen to Truth News. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away.
man to man is so unjust. Children, you don't know who to trust. Your worst enemy could be your best friend, and your best friend your worst enemy.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I'd like to move on now with a reading from an article by John Pilger, well-known Australian journalist and filmmaker, on the subject of refugees and Australia's politicians and election campaign strategies. The title of the article is "Australia's Election Campaign is Driven by a Barbarism That Dares Not Speak Its Name." John Pilger, of course, is an extremely ardent and hard-bitten journalist who just really breaks the mold on what you should and shouldn't say in the mainstream. And to me, I don't see John Pilger as being a left-wing or a right-wing person. He has a lot of support from the socialist organisations in Australia and around the world. But he certainly deviates from the accepted sort of memes that you get from organizations like that. He really cuts across the divide, and I see him as just a truly independent voice. And I'm really thankful that we do actually have someone who's well known and who has actually made movies from Australia who says it like it is. And this article really says it like it is. Dated July 30, 2013, and published on Information Clearinghouse. The election campaign in Australia is being fought with the lives of men, women, and children. Some drown, others are banished without hope to malarial camps. Children are incarcerated behind razor wire in conditions described as a huge generator of mental illness. This barbarism is considered a vote winner by both the Australian government and the opposition. Reminiscent of the closing of borders to Jews in the 1930s, it is smashing the facade of a society advertised as benign and lucky. If 1,000 Australians drowned in sinking boats in Sydney Harbour, the Prime Minister would lead the nation in mourning. The world would offer condolences. By one measure, 1,376 refugees have drowned trying to reach Australia since 1998, many within range of rescue. The policy known in Canberra as Stop the Boats evokes the hysteria and cynicism of more than a century ago, when the Yellow Peril was said to be falling down on Australia as if by the force of gravity. Last week, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd reached back to this era when he declared that no refugees in boats would be permitted to land in Australia. Instead, they are to be sent to concentration camps in impoverished Papua New Guinea, whose government has been suitably bribed. Among them are people fleeing wars and their aftermath, for which Australia and its US mentor bear responsibility. Those who survive are made prisoners in a harsh gulag on the most isolated islands on earth. Women and children sent to Equatorial Manus Island already have had to be evacuated because of mosquito-infested conditions. Now Manus is to receive 3,000 more refugees who, denied legal rights, may spend years there. A former security guard on the island said, "It's worse than a prison, actually. Words can't really describe it. I have never seen human beings so destitute, so helpless, and so hopeless. In Australia, the facility could not serve as a dog kennel. Its owners would be jailed." Australia is a signatory to the 1951 Refugee Convention. Rudd's actions are not only lawless actions, but weaken international refugee law and the human rights movements that buttress it. In 1992, the Labor government of Paul Keating was the first to impose illegal mandatory detention of refugees, including children, Now, that's something that's quite interesting. I did not know that myself, that in fact it was under Paul Keating that we first had mandatory detention. That wasn't very long ago, folks. You've got to understand, things have actually changed a lot in the last 20 years. We've moved into a whole new phase of the clampdown of government control and nanny state and really violations of human rights on a grand scale. Just returning to the article here. Since then, Australian governments have waged a propaganda war on refugees in alliance with a media dominated by Rupert Murdoch. Vast, sparsely populated Australia demands protection from refugees and asylum seekers, of whom fewer than 15,000 were settled last year, 0.99% of the world's total. The punitive, racist nature of this policy allows the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, to assess people in secret and detain them indefinitely, such as Tamils fleeing the civil war in Sri Lanka. Many have no idea why they are imprisoned, and this has included children. Clearly, Rudd hopes to be re-elected on this fear card. British politicians play a similar game. But in Australia, race is all but genetically inscribed, as in apartheid South Africa. The Federation of the Australian States in 1901 was founded on racial exclusion and a dread of non-existent hordes from as far away as Russia. A 1940s policy of populate or perish produced a vibrant multiculturalism. Yet a crude, often unconscious racism remains an extraordinary current in Australian society and is exploited by a political elite with an enduring colonial mentality and an obsequiousness to Western interests. Rudd's banishment of refugees who come by sea is designed to wrong-foot his opponent, the Conservative coalition leader, Tony Abbott, a Catholic fundamentalist. Labour restored Rudd to the leadership last month because Julia Gillard's unpopularity threatened to destroy the party at the polls, and with it, Australia's Westminster-style club of two major parties with mostly indistinguishable policies. Rudd's move was nothing new. Bashing the vulnerable is said to win votes in Australia, whether they are refugees or Aborigines. His predecessor, John Howard, bashed both. Shortly before the 2001 election, Howard claimed that people on a stricken boat had thrown their children into the sea and so could not be genuine refugees. Later, it was revealed the children overboard story was a fabrication. 2 weeks before the next election in 2007, Howard declared a state of emergency in the Northern Territory and sent the army into impoverished Indigenous communities where, his minister Mal Brupp claimed, pedophile gangs were abusing children in unthinkable numbers. The Australian Crime Commission, the Northern Territory Police and medical specialists who examined 11,000 children found his allegations to be false. Although Howard failed to win this election, his vicious campaign of smear and dispossession, he demanded Aboriginal people hand over the leasehold of their land, succeeded in devastating whole communities which have yet to recover. A government review of what became known as the intervention found a collective despair among black Australians. The Australian Indigenous Doctors Association reported widespread hunger and starvation. Self-harm and attempted suicide quadrupled. As opposition leader at the time, Rudd gave Howard full support. Later, as Prime Minister, he made an emotional public apology to the tens of thousands of Aboriginal Australians wrenched from their families during the 20th century, known as the Stolen Generation. Quietly, Rudd refused the victims compensation of any kind. Had they been white, he would not have dared. When I asked him about this, he replied, "These questions should be dealt with over time. With Aboriginal life expectancy among the lowest in the world, The victims have no time. Labour has since allowed the very assimilationist cruelties for which Rudd apologised. In a one-year period to June last year, 13,000 impoverished Aboriginal children were taken from their families, more than during any of the infamous years of the Stolen Generation. Okay, we'll have to leave it there. That's just about the end of that article, but a very passionate and important contribution there by John Pilger, which I will post on the Truth News page. We'll be right back after this break. Do stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. I want to turn now to another story for the remaining segment of the show. I want to talk a little bit about an event which took place in Libya, which I haven't really talked about on this show before. It's extremely important. I'm talking about the murder of the US ambassador in Benghazi, which has been really glossed over in the news. It certainly popped up as a story, but you know, like it didn't really capture a lot of attention. It came and went, and we were told, of course, that there were riots, and the U.S. government could do nothing about it. And you know, it's just too bad. You know, the ambassador was killed by these Muslim extremists. And you know, there are a few things that really need to be highlighted about it. As this is actually now resurfacing as a major theme, there's a new Citizens Commission of Inquiry being launched. There are people who have come forward and said that there was an official stand down order. Now, for those of us familiar with 9/11, the concept of a stand down order certainly rings a lot of bells, and it also indicates when some sort of deliberate operation is in progress, whether it be a false flag operation or whether it is actually to do with the powers within the government basically wanting to take out someone who they regard as being a problem. Of course, you know, the stand down of the CIA in Dallas in that fateful day in 1963 when JFK was shot again springs to mind. Now, this is a story from a few months ago. We had Anne Louise Wagner, U.S. representative for Missouri, on a radio show saying that, in fact, there was a stand-down order given. We had a situation where there was a situation of extreme violence. You had the ambassador, the representative of the U.S. government in Libya, at the mercy of these people, and the US had special operations forces ready to go, but they were told not to do anything, not to step in, and they didn't rescue him, and he and I believe two other diplomats were killed. Now, I mean, let's just reflect on this for a moment. The murder of a US ambassador is by any estimation an act of war. I mean, it is an extreme, extreme act. And what I can tell you just from my common sense, what is quite apparent to me, is that this would not have been done if the perpetrators thought that there would be retribution. And normally there would be. Normally the retribution would be swift and overwhelming. I mean, we'd be talking about missile strikes. We'd be talking about basically an act of war met with another act of war. Because killing the ambassador is an act of war. So I think even by the international standards of war, I think America would be justified in taking military action to deal with this type of event. But of course they didn't. And it disappeared from the news so quickly. But I want to play to you now a clip of an interview with Anne Wagner in which she actually makes it quite clear that there was indeed a stand-down order.
DanaRadio.com, 971talk.com/Dana, and we're continuing to follow the Benghazi hearings. But right now, joining me is Congresswoman Anne Wagner, Representative Anne Wagner, from our great state of Missouri. I want to ask you as well about the big issue of the day, these Benghazi hearings. I know you've been following them. It is really disturbing to me. We learned that one of the witnesses slash whistleblowers actually called then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at 2:01 in the morning to brief her about what was happening in Benghazi, to tell her that 60 terrorists had walked onto U.S. soil on that consulate and were carrying out an attack. I'm trying to figure out, Representative, how it went from the Secretary of State being briefed that this was a terror attack. All of the deputy diplomats, everyone on the ground knew, they knew this was a terror attack right off. How it went from that to let's blame it on a YouTube video.
It's absolutely outrageous. And to listen to, the deputy chief of mission, Hicks, give his testimony is amazing. And this is the crack we've been waiting for. I mean, it truly is. To think that that on August 16th, the ambassador Stevens asked for more security, and it was completely ignored. I'm a former United States ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
When I sent a cable like that, you know, imploring the State Department for more security for the American diplomats on the ground, it would never have been ignored. It's reprehensible. Yet, at the same time, the president was out. President Obama was out campaigning, talking about how Al-Qaeda was decimated, and in fact, it's not the case. And to me, I think the saddest testimony that we heard today was that our special ops in Tripoli were on their way to a Libyan C-30 to load up and to go and to do something. And they were denied permission by AFRICOM. I mean, they watched this unfold and happen. And we'll continue to listen to the testimony and see what comes out. But as I said, everything from the cover up and the days afterward to the lack of response on the ground to real people. I mean, this Ambassador Chris Stevens, Sean Smith, the information officer, Tyron Woods, the former Navy SEAL, Glenn Darty. These are men who all had families. They're real people, and their government let them down. It's on all fronts. So I'm outraged. I'm outraged as an American, as a member of Congress, mm-hmm. and certainly as someone that did stand as a chief
yes.
of mission, as a U.S. ambassador.
And last quick question I have for you, Congresswoman, because you have been an ambassador, you have been overseas with similar responsibilities and similar missions. Who gives such an order to stand down? Where does that come from?
The President of the United States.
Wow. Wow. I so appreciate you joining me this afternoon.
There we have it. A complete admission from a member of the U.S. government that there was indeed a stand-down order, and that the U.S. president would have to have been behind that. And that's been confirmed from a number of other people who've stepped forward in this whole controversy. And I have another interview here with Lieutenant General Thomas McKinney on Fox, who confirms some aspects of that military stand-down.
Well, I think what we're going to see, and I also hope, but we're going to hear some of the actual facts, Lou, by people that were on the ground or involved back in State Department and other National Military Command centers, although there won't be any direct military people. That is very important because it has become very obvious that we had dereliction of duty of our senior leaders, and we lost four people that, frankly, we didn't have to lose, Lou. We didn't have to lose anybody. The indications and warning were there. The day before, Zawahiri put out a video that was really the execution of the order to attack the Benghazi consulate the next day. That was an indication warning that the intel people should have picked up. We should have had forces in place. That was 18 hours before the actual attack, so they should have been moved at that time.
And now, I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
Even though they were not moved at that time, we still could have gotten forces from Aviano, our air base in northern Italy that has F-16s and other assets in theater. Now, there was no cognizance that 9/11, it didn't fit the narrative that 9/11 was an important day, and so like they were oblivious to the magnitude of 9/11 in the region.
One of the whistleblowers, Gregory Hicks, the number two U.S. envoy in Libya, during the attack, told investigators his request for fighter jets was denied. He says a team of special forces were prepared to fly from Tripoli to Benghazi during those attacks, but were forbidden from doing so by U.S. Special Operations Command. Your thoughts, your reaction to what will be presumably his testimony tomorrow?
Well, there's only one person that can say stand down, and that's what those troops, the special ops forces that were going to get on that C-130 at Tripoli and fly over, and that's the President of the United States. And so for us to deny forces to go to the aid of our people, we never leave people behind, Lou. And this is where the dereliction of duty comes in. And it permeates the whole command and control system to say that, well, we couldn't get the airplanes down there, we couldn't get approval for airspace. That doesn't matter, Lou. You take action and you move out. I'm actually ashamed of the way our military responded. Not the men and women of the military, but our senior leaders, and it's disgraceful.
Now, this is all being framed by the conservative media as dereliction of duty, disgraceful incompetency on the part of the Obama government. But, of course, that is simply another talking point, another aspect of the agenda of the two-party system where they talk about the failings of the other side. But in reality, it's much more than just negligence. It's much more than just incompetency. It's quite clearly calumny. I mean, it's impossible to look at this without realizing that this stand-down order was given for a reason. We don't know the reason. We don't know why they wanted to eliminate the U.S. ambassador. But in plain sight, something has been shifted in your perception, which I just want to bring to our attention. And I know that many other sites and news shows have commented on this, but on that note, it's goodbye for another week. We will be back with new news and commentary. See you then.